Welcome to In the Limelight with Clarissa Burt, international media celebrity, supermodel, and renowned beauty and lifestyle expert, as well as founder and CEO of Envelop Her, multimedia platform for women, and sought-after inspirational speaker on women's issues. You'll connect with Clarissa's super influencer celebrity friends and experts as they speak about health, wealth, beauty, lifestyle, business, the love of giving, and the love of living a model life. Now, here is Clarissa Burt.
Hey, everybody, you are here in the limelight with Voice America here on Influencers Channel. I am so thrilled to be back because, as you know, last week we had to do a rerun. I was in New York City at the National Publicity Summit, and then this past week, I just got back from Albuquerque and was out at the Power of Purpose conference, and that was all about nonprofits. So I'm getting really thrilled about the fact that I'm moving into the nonprofit world and that we're going to be doing some really amazing things for women all over the globe very soon. I've got a really, really extraordinary guest today. Thrilled to have him on. A friend of mine. I don't know him for too long, but we've met on a couple of different occasions, and he's just a powerhouse. He's a superstar. And I wanted everybody to have a chance to meet him, to greet him, and maybe ask him a couple of questions as we go. This friend of mine, this super influencer, puts Where's Waldo to shame, because every time you look him up or every time he's, you know, hitting you up on social media, he's somewhere else in the world. Now, I'm going to ask him where he is now, because God only knows where that could be. I'm welcoming Jeff Hoffman. He is a successful entrepreneur. You guys probably know Priceline really well. Well, he's the brains behind that. And he's a CEO. He's a motivational speaker. I've heard him speak on a couple of different occasions. And it's one of those kind of speakers where when he's on stage, you can't hear a pin drop. Everybody's really, really, just honed in on what he's saying. And he's funnier than hell. So that's really always a nice plus. And he's also a producer. Yeah, he's produced some films and a Grammy award-winning jazz. Anyway, I'm going to let you tell everybody about it. Jeff, good morning and welcome to In the Limelight.
Good morning, Clarissa. Now I'm afraid it can only go downhill from here after that intro.
Well, yeah, I could have gone on forever, you know, with your bio and all of your accolades. I could have just done your bio and you didn't even have to show up for the show. But you're here now. And so where are you, Jeff Hoffman, today?
So I did just get back from Istanbul, but I'm in the United States of America in Ohio now.
After a good
trip to Istanbul.
Awesome. Well, I've seen you've been doing a lot of really great trips lately, and you normally do. You know, I think since I've known you in the last couple of years, and we've sort of been in each other's sphere and realm, and, you know, especially on social media, you're really never home. I mean, you're always out and about doing something. And, you know, this, I think, is also because you really do serve on the boards of numerous different companies in the U.S., Europe, South America, Africa, and Asia. And you're also out supporting entrepreneurs and small businesses in about 150 different countries. But what I really love about you the most is how much time you take with our younger generations. So can we talk a little bit about, first of all, where do you get the energy? Because you said, you know, you went to this Think Big Summit, you had 450 students there, and you went, I don't know where they get the energy. And I went, Jeff, you got to be kidding me. Like, where do you get the energy? You're constantly on the road. I would say on the road, you're constantly in the air, but go ahead.
That's my mission, but you pretty much hit the nail on the head. I get the energy from them. Sometimes just from running around, and especially as they get older, I'm completely wiped out. Then I get to a place, for example, just this trip I just took to Istanbul in Turkey, I got a chance to spend an afternoon and evening with about 200 high school students from around their country. And I was tired and jet lagged when I got there, but as soon as, and it was actually a beautiful day when we were outside, as soon as I got in the middle of 200 high school students, they all started asking me questions. You just draw the energy from them. They're excited about their future. They believe in themselves, everything about it. So that's also, by the way, one of the benefits of youth. When I go spend time with young people, their energy just becomes contagious, and it makes me want to get up and do it all again the next day.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, I have to say I love working with the young kids too. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think are the major differences between the eighth graders that, you know, you were talking to, a dreamwalkers, and when you were in the eighth grade? Like, what are the major differences that are happening, apart from internet and social media and all of that? But what do you kind of see beating in their heart or capture in their soul?
Well, you know, I would say that the social media piece is the biggest piece, but not for the reason people think, not for the trading pics and songs and, you know, and Snapchatting and stuff like that. It's the fact that we became one big globally connected village. So it used to be wherever you grew up in any part of the world or in any part of this country, that's kind of all you knew because right. You saw people like you all day that grew mm-hmm. up near you, behaved like you and you know, were similar to you. And right. what happened in the social media world was young people started to connect and see other people like them all over the world and realize that everybody isn't the same. Everybody's mm-hmm. opportunities aren't the same. Everybody's rules aren't the same.
Right.
I think it woke up a generation. I've been to places where, you know, it might be, you know, for example, you just mentioned that I've been doing these Dream Wakers. These are mm-hmm. video calls with students, but we sometimes speak into rural areas and we mm-hmm. connect online and video into schools in less advantaged parts of this country. And when you get yeah. a chance to talk to them and open their eyes and they get to learn about and hear about things that are going on elsewhere in their own country, right here in the U.S. of A.,
right.
They start to realize that there's opportunities that they don't see where they grow up and where they live,
right.
but they're
right.
suddenly curious and they're connected and they talk to other people like them. So I think it opened people's eyes to the fact that they can see that everybody doesn't live like I live, and that's mm-hmm. and you know, that's sometimes a blessing, but sometimes right. it's an opportunity.
Absolutely, it's an opportunity. Sorry, I said dream walkers. It is dream wakers. Yeah, I love the fact. In fact, you've said it in one of your speeches, or I read it somewhere online about you. You say we're one big human family, right? All of us, because of this global happening in this global movement. And internet has really changed everything so dramatically and so drastically that we are one big human family, and everybody can take a look at one another and say, well, we are different. We don't have the same possibilities, but we all have an opportunity. So that's a really great point. You were recently also at the Global Entrepreneurship Congress, and you were sporting some pretty spiffy clothes there from Niger.
I can tell you.
Love that.
We had entrepreneurs and representatives from 170 countries all join us.
Right.
And my message, I was opening up the session on stage, and I was mm-hmm. trying to think of an appropriate message to kick off our global event. And the message was, we are all one big human family. And mm-hmm. as I was walking over there, the people from the country of Niger came up and said, Mr. Hoffman, we just want to thank you for, you know, all the sort of charitable work you do trying to educate and help people, and we brought you a gift. And the gift is the traditional clothing that men wear in Niger, in Africa. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was carrying those, walking to the stage, thinking, my message is we are all one. And I thought,
right.
what better way to
better opportunity,
walk
right.
the walk
yeah.
Yeah, than to just put on these clothes. And the crazy part, Clarissa, was they fit. completely.
So how did you pull that off? Did you like run to the men's room or something? Or did you have a room in the backstage? How did you do
well,
that?
Well, now I'll tell you the truth. I went to the green room and there were people in there, media.
Uh-oh.
So I went
yeah.
out and I went down the hall and there was a meeting room where the meeting had finished and everybody left. I went in the room, I closed the door, I took all my clothes off, and sure enough, because nature has a sense of humor, as soon as I was standing there, nothing but my underwear, the door opened.
Oh, God.
And a man came in, looked at me, and without saying a word, just slowly backed away and closed the door. I don't know
That's
what he reported
right.
to security. Yeah, there's a man what? In his underwear standing down the hall, but I put the clothes on and went on stage.
Yeah, you look spectacular. The picture was great. I loved it. Do you still get nervous when you go on stage?
I don't get nervous. What I think about, because I only talk, you know, somebody said to me, do you give speeches? And I said, not at all. I just talk about things I'm passionate about. So I never feel like a speaker. I feel like a conversationalist. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about something I really care about, and I'm mm-hmm. into it. So I don't get nervous, but I get what concerns me sometimes is making sure that you're connecting in an audience in a way that something is different when they leave. If you give a speech, a talk or whatever, and mm-hmm. people clap, and then they go back to exactly what they were doing before and nothing changes,
mm-hmm.
to me, I walk away. I said, you know, there's an afternoon I won't get back.
Without a doubt.
I do this because I'm hoping to make some impact and that someone will do something different than they would have before that. So that's what I think about. I don't get nervous. I get concerned that, you know, we have the right message to the right audience and it will actually cause some positive result.
So no pacing up and down, no sweaty palms, none of that whole thing. It depends on the audience. It depends on the size of the audience. And it just depends. You know, I mean, I basically have been brought up on stage, right? So for me, it's pretty easy to be in a microphone or be on a stage. I'm pretty good to go. But yeah, I get a little nervous every once in a while. I have to admit, I do.
I have a big one coming up in 2 weeks at the United Nations in the big room. So I don't know if nervous is the right word, but I'm concerned that, you know, in a stage like that, an opportunity like that, that I deliver the right message to the right people. So there's one I might be a little nervous for.
Okay. So you just really want to make sure that your message is getting out there and it's changing somebody's life, at least one person in the room, if not more. You're a happy camper when you leave the stage.
Correct.
I think that's pretty noble. I think that's a great idea. We only have a couple of minutes till we go to our first break. So, I wanted to, you know, to remind you that when we first met, it was in Philadelphia about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago, I guess, at Ken Courtwright's Digital Footprint event. Mm-hmm. And first of all, it was April and it was snowing outside. I don't know if you remember that, but which was odd. You told a story about a little girl who was 5 years old. And I just thought it was one of the funniest things I had ever heard, because not only are you a great speaker, but you're extremely engaging and very funny. So I wanted you to give us a little idea as to who this little 5-year-old girl was, first of all, because you told us about the little girl, but we had no idea who she was. How did this 5-year-old girl get in your life?
Oh, niece.
Okay.
I volunteered to babysit for the day.
Okay. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay. So, this was a really big epiphany moment in my life for thinking about the way we think about the world around them, because I had the 5-year-old. I was going to stay home from work and babysit for the day. I realized I left something at the office and I said to her, we got to run up to the office, go get in the car. And the reason 5-year-olds are important is 5 is the age where children question everything. When you say, you know, put your shoes on, why? Because we got to go outside. Why? Because we got to go to the store. Why? Because we need food. Why? Everything you tell a 5-year-old, they want to know, they want a valid answer for why. And so I said to the 5-year-old, you get in the car, we got to run up to the office. And she's walking across the room. She's looking down, shuffling her feet. And she says to me, how do they make carpet? And I said, I have no idea how they make carpet. Just get in the car. And she said, well, just tell me how they make it. And I said, look, my company doesn't make carpet. And there's no point in my life that I need to know how to make carpet.
I have no clue.
So I don't care.
Get in the car.
Just get in the car. So she says, well, you know, you went to school. I said, they don't teach you carpet just because you go to school. Right. And she's kind of disappointed. She shakes her head. She walks out to the garage. She walks up to the car. She taps on the window. I said, get in. And she says, how do they make glass? I wonder how they make glass. I said, I have no reason to know how they make glass. No desire to learn that. My company doesn't make glass. Get in the car. And she said, well, just tell me how they make glass. And I said, I don't know. And she said, well, you're an adult. And I said, they don't teach you how to make glass just because you become an adult. And she said, you have no idea, do you? And I remember there's that TV show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? I'm losing to a 5-year-old. And I'm a little defensive. So I remember in 8th grade, we did a glass blowing factory trip. And I told her, well, I think they have like flame and sand and they melt sand. And she shook her head in disgust. And she said, you don't even know how they make glass. I said, look, get in the car. So before she gets in, she taps on the, there's a black plastic strip between the front and the back window of a car. She goes, what is this called? I said, it's not called anything. It's just a plastic thing between the two windows. And she said, no, but what's it called? I said, it's not called anything. And she said, I wonder what they call it, what the name is. I said, it's not named anything. Just get in the car. And the 5-year-old turned to me and she said, if this piece doesn't have a name, how would they order more of these on an assembly line? So I stood there dumbfounded. By the way, I told this story in Detroit and everyone in the entire audience knew the part number and SKU number. That thing is called the B-pole. It does have a name, which I never knew. Anyway, we get to the office where she's walking to the office and she turns to me. As we walk in, there's this table in the lobby of our office that has these two machines on it. And she can't stop with the questions. She said, what's that machine and why do you have two of those? And I mean, everything we went to the office, she questioned. Why do you print that thing? What does that guy do? Why is that girl on the phone? I finally got her into the snack or the break room to have a snack. I sat down in my chair and I was exasperated, but I realized I wasn't upset at her. I was upset that I couldn't answer one single question the whole day this five-year-old asked me.
Right.
So I get up, I walk down the hall, I call my office manager. And I say, what are those two machines in our lobby? And she looks over there and she goes, it's your company. You own the place. I said, but I don't know what those are. And she said, well, they've been here since I started. I don't know either. So I said, ask around. She asked around. No one in the office knows what those two machines in our lobby are. And we all work here every day. So I call my CFO and I said, I need you to go figure this out. And I'm whispering, and he said, why are you talking so quiet? I said, I don't want the five-year-old to know that I'm the CEO. And I have no idea what's going on here. So we get, he comes back, and 30 minutes later, he goes, boss, I have good news and bad news.
Right.
And I said, what's the good news? He said, figure out what those machines are. He said, back in the days before PowerPoint, we used to print our own presentations, bind them, and collate them. That's a binding machine from before PowerPoint. And I said, wow, what's the bad news? And he leans over and he goes, yeah, boss, we're leasing these.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
I have
That's
no
amazing.
Idea how long we've been leasing the machines. So let me just end the story by telling you this. We get so used to our surroundings and to seeing the same things every day that we stop wondering about everything or anything. So I did an experiment. Clarissa, I told all my employees, I said, Friday, I want you all to come to work, and I encourage anybody listening to us right now to try this. I said, I want you to do five-year-old day. I want you to come in, and I want everyone that works here to question everything around them and keep saying why until either you get a good answer or we're going to stop doing it. If no one knows why we do things the way we do them, question everything. And it was amazing. We do it twice a year now. We do five-year-old day. We walk
You're
in and we
kidding.
Just question everything like we've never been in an office before. And every time we probably get a 30 or 40% improvement in our operational efficiency.
Yeah, that's amazing.
We
that's
stop
crazy.
Doing all the stuff that no one wondered about anymore. Try
so
it
why
sometime.
Was that girl on the phone all day long?
Yeah, good,
did you fire her or is she still around?
The funnier one was when the five-year-old said, why are you printing that big thing of paper? I walked over and I asked, I said, what is this? And one of my employees said, we call it Management Report 3. I said, what do you do with it? And he said, we send it to this list of customers. I called the first customer on the list. And I said, why do you get this report? Because I was doing the five-year-old thing. And he said, because you keep sending it to me. I said, oh. I said, what do you do with this report? And we send it to you. He said, when it's warm out, I use it to prop my door open.
Oh, God.
So I went back.
No,
I asked the employee.
Oh my God.
I said, why do you keep printing this report and sending it? He said something horrifying. He said, this company hired me 2 years ago. They told me my job was to print this report every month and mail it. And then he paused and he said, no one ever told me to stop doing that.
Oh God.
Think about that. How many things
That's
go on
crazy.
In the world
yeah.
around you because yeah. no one ever questioned them again?
Yeah, for sure.
They were, they Not made sense constant, when you started
productivity.
Doing
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, productivity. Yeah, so That was a big learning.
That was a big learning. Wow. So thank you, niece. How old is your niece now?
College.
Oh, God, you're kidding. Oh, wow. Okay.
Nope. We've been doing this all these years since then.
And she must be a genius, right? She's like another walking genius like you.
I think so, but.
I bet you do. So we've got lots more questions for you, and this is exciting. You're really good friends with Holly Field. And I wanted you to tell that story because it's so endearing. We love the guy. We know him well. You know, I followed some of the stuff that he did some years ago. I haven't seen him in a long time. But first of all, how often do you see him? How is he? And what is the connection between the two of you?
Actually, I just saw him last weekend. We've been working on some projects together and also working on mentoring entrepreneurs. He comes along. He works with me on some of those. So I see him pretty often. But you know, the importance of that lesson was that all the best plans in the world, and, you know, no matter how smart you are and how great your plan is, none of this matters if you don't put in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for example, I have a sign in my office that says, ideas are welcome here, but execution is worshipped. Because in the end, it's whoever does the work. And a lot of times, you know, all of us see people that are really successful and we think, well, she's just smarter than me. She's mm-hmm. somehow better than me. That's why she's successful. And the truth is, they're not. You don't have to be the smartest person in the room. Typically, these are the people that just outworked everyone else. Mm-hmm. I have really smart friends who do nothing. And I have friends that aren't, quote, nearly that smart, but have been successful. And so here was the story. Right. Evander was, at the time, he was the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. And we've been friends for more than 20 years. So I used to go with him to all his fights. Mm-hmm. And he was training for a big fight, the heavyweight championship. Mm-hmm. And I was at his house, and he was working out. And he was doing this exercise that he does 300 times a day. And I was just spotting and counting for him. And the exercise is ridiculous. It's something that, you know, most human beings couldn't do 10 reps of, and he does this mm-hmm. thing 300 times. Are you kidding me? 300 times yeah. every day? He's nuts. And I was counting, and he got to the end. And Evander said, I said 299, 300, and he stopped in midair with the weights and all the muscles rippling in the sweat. And he said, hey, Jeff, was that 299 or 300? I said, dude, it was 300. And he said, I'm going to ask you again, did I do 299 or 300? And I was like, whatever, you did 300. And he goes back, without taking his eyes off me, he goes back down to the floor. And he says, I think he does one more rep. And he says, I think it was only 299. Well, here's a mistake I made. When he said that, I rolled my eyes. Like, you got to be kidding. You do 300 right. every day of your life. You know, what difference does it make? And he sat back up, and he turns, and he goes, look at me. And I remember thinking, well, that was a short life. This was not the guy to pick a fight with. Mike Tyson bit his ear off because he was afraid of him.
So, wow.
But Evander said something to me in that moment that changed my life for real. He looked at me and he said, the difference between doing 299 and finishing 300 is the difference between heavyweight champion of the world and every other boxer. And yeah. I just froze. I closed my eyes. I had goosebumps. I didn't move for 10 minutes. He silently walked away because I wanted that message to soak into my soul, because here's the message. That is the difference between successful people and everybody else. It isn't rocket science. If 299 is good enough for you today, tomorrow, hey, 298 is almost 299. And the next day, 297, that's almost 298. And meanwhile, somebody down the road is doing 300 of whatever you're doing and they're going to beat you. And I took that to heart.
Awesome
whatever
lesson.
You set out to do in life, do it 300.
Yeah.
Do it as the best you possible can every single time. That is the path to excellence. I have a thing on my wall. I have the number 299 with a red circle and a slash through it to remind me no 299s around here.
Of course you do. You know, I think a lot of people that are listening are probably going, I'm probably a 299er, or I have been, you know, on many occasions. And this is an awesome story for, it sets a phenomenal example also just to do the 300. So I'm going to get that. Where do we get that sign, Jeff? Did you make it up yourself, or did you have it made, or should we just?
I made that, the original one myself. But you know what I kind of like now? I get these from when I've shared that story from different places around the world. Okay. People send me a picture of their 299, their no 299 sign. I got one from Bulgaria. A guy made a little no 299 sign. He stuck it in his wall. He said, hey, I just wanted to share with you that I get it.
Right.
I think that's really cool.
So you also, I saw, I really love this too, is that you're encouraging girls and collaborating or working with girls. I want you to tell me a little bit more in some of the STEM work that we're trying to get our girls to get more interested in. What are you finding out there in the field with these young girls?
Yeah, we're just trying to level the playing field. So I've been spending a lot of time with women's organizations, and recently I keynoted a global conference for women in STEM. And last year I did the Women in Technology International, their global conference. It's more normal and natural, right, that we encourage young boys to get into math and electronics and engineering and tech and science. Mm-hmm. And it's just not statistically. We don't have the same number of women in it, and they're not exposed to it and encouraged the same way. So the whole STEM effort, or even STEAM, whichever one you want, now everyone that was STEAM because they threw robotics in there.
Oh, okay.
But the whole effort to push more young girls to focus on science and technology early on, I think is important and needed. So I've been trying to be supportive of any effort that introduces girls at a younger and younger age to technology.
Right.
And
so,
I, think it's so many women are getting involved. I think it's great.
Yeah, I think it's great too. Speaking of robotics, there's a picture of you with a robot. I don't know exactly where. And you said that when your days back in Yale, which I don't know how many years ago that was, but maybe we won't mention that. I just am, you know, you said that, I don't know, that you, that we're all, you were already talking about artificial intelligence back in your college days. So how long has it been around? How far has it come and how far is it going to go?
It's been around for decades now. The government spent a lot of money long ago trying to develop the technology just to see what they could do with it. So it's been around for a long time, but it wasn't practical because to the decision making, the software side of artificial intelligence took so much computing power that it was cost prohibitive. But mm-hmm. now that you hold in your phone, you know, more compute power in your hand than used to fill an entire room. Before, we have so much power now, the computing has gotten so much more cost-effective and powerful that the software, the algorithmic side of artificial intelligence runs. That's why you have devices like Alexa or Siri that, you know, everybody can use now. I think we're now on the tip of the iceberg of actually using it. You know what? I have an Alexa on my desk, and I love to ask her increasingly either strange or more difficult questions every week to see how much smarter she's getting. And what happens is you'll ask her a question and she'll say, I'm afraid I don't understand. Then I'll ask it a month later and she'll answer it. Right. And I'm like, wait, how do you know that now? You didn't know it before. The technology is getting smarter and smarter, which is scary, I know, to a lot of people.
Right.
That robot that you saw me with and that was out in the Silicon Valley, that robot was talking to me almost like a human. We were having a conversation and asked me if I needed a cold drink. And I said, yes. And it walked down the hall to a refrigerator and got me a Diet Coke.
Oh, no.
I was like, you've got to be kidding me. And it brought it back and said, here you go. I was like, this is scary. But there's a good side. Think about this. Think about, for example, medicine, right? A doctor, when you come in, tries to remember, have I seen a mark, you know, a rash like that before or whatever? And doctors might read through some files. But the doctor's experience base is the patients they've dealt with.
Right.
But artificial intelligence is software that would look through millions of patients all over the world in mere seconds and say, I compared this to 3 million people in 27 countries.
Wow, that's
and now I know exactly what's wrong with you. Your doctor can't do that as much as they'd like to.
No,
so I think AI is going to have some amazingly beneficial, some benefits for us.
Absolutely. Well, I think we're going to go to break now. We've spoken for about a half an hour, and that was a little bit of a marathon here on In the Limelight with Clarissa Burr, Jeff. All right, everybody, we're going to be back with Jeff Hoffman. Do not go away. There's a lot more interesting questions I've got for him, for sure. Don't go away.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events. Do you believe that being fit is difficult? Do you think it requires turning in your favorite comfort foods for boring chicken and broccoli and spending hours in a gym? It doesn't. Tune into Have It All with Devin Alexander. Devin and her guest experts will show you how you can have it all at any age, from relationships to money to thinking bigger than you've ever imagined. Devin will fast track your goals to yummy reality. Tune in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time and 12 noon Eastern Time on the Voice America Influencers Channel.
Are you ready for provocative discussions with some of today's most powerful movers and shakers? Tune in to The Art of Significance, featuring Dan Clark, the modern-day Napoleon Hill, who interviews the wealthiest, most successful celebrities and business leaders on the planet, who are using their influence to change the world. From authors to entertainers, sports figures, educators, to military leaders, Dan covers multiple topics. Tune in every Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Voice America Influencers channel.
Change starts here. Change starts now. Join us, the Voice America Influencers Channel.
You are listening to In the Limelight with Clarissa Burt. You can call into the program at 1-866-472-5795. Again, that's 1-866-472-5795. Or send an email to info@clarissaburt.com. Now back to In the Limelight.
You are back in the limelight. We are with Jeff Hoffman today, and you may better know Jeff as a super influencer, and he is also the founder of Priceline.com. And so that's kind of cool. I think that's really kind of neat. What about UBID and Color Jar? They are also other startups that became very, very successful. UBID, I took a look at today, and it's still online. Are you still involved with that?
No, not anymore.
Not anymore. And Color Jar?
Yeah, yes. Color Jar is kind of a design and development company based in Chicago.
And so what are you, are there specific things that you're looking for Color Jar?
No, it's really more focused on launching. Our expertise mm-hmm. is if you've got an idea for a product or service you want to launch into the world, we'll help you get that focused and built and launched into the world. So that's really the main expertise there is making sure that your product is positioned properly, pointed at the right people, and ready to launch when you flip the switch.
Right. So as I said before at the top of the show, you know, reading your bio is, you know, it's just, you're just an extraordinarily successful man. And I wanted to know, were there any failures along the way, things that just kind of didn't work out, or did everything you ever touch turn, like, you know, like have the Midas touch on everything?
No, we definitely had our failures. I had this idea for a company years ago that I thought you didn't really need to go to the mall to buy that sweater because you have a computer at home and you could buy it online. So I tried to launch an internet company way before people knew what the internet was, and it failed miserably. So we have definitely had our moments where we look back and said, well, that was a bad idea.
Right. And I love the story that you tell, especially when, you know, you came up with the idea Priceline was, you know, being at the airport, you know, feeling frustrated, you know, or actually making the phone call. And the woman was, the travel agent was trying to, you know, to get you to buy either the 4 o'clock or the 6 o'clock, I think it was, a flight, and you wanted to go at 5 o'clock or something along those lines. And she was absolutely, you know, she was pushing the Delta thing when you knew there was another flight on another airline that you could have been taking. And that really frustrated you. You found out that that frustrated many other people, right? So that's kind of the basis for how Priceline was born.
Well, yeah, those were companies. That was actually two different travel companies before we even ever got to Priceline. So I've been in the travel biz for a long time. But yeah, it's born out of the same thing. And again, for any listeners, next time you see a problem, when you're standing there and something is frustrating you and you're having a problem, instead of just complaining, maybe you say, I wonder if I could fix this. So that's kind of been the history for us. Including, for example, one of my companies, which was well before Priceline existed as well, was designing and building the airline check-in kiosk. When you go to the airport now and you check in at a ticket printer, that was something that was born out of my frustration, standing in a line so long to check in the airport that I actually missed the flight.
Right.
So when you see a problem, ask yourself.
Well, just because
this
they had to print, they just because just to get a printed boarding pass, right?
Yeah,
that was the whole
just
point.
A boarding pass.
Right.
Right.
So when you think, why can't I print this elsewhere? You know, yeah, the kiosk is great, and now you can do it at home as well, which is really cool. So yeah, I absolutely see that. That, you know, that the lesson here is, you know, what else? If it's bothering you, it's probably bothering other people. There's your opportunity. The other
Absolutely.
Thing you talk about is if you've got six different great ideas, Jeff, I've got six great, you know, ideas. I got them all on the burner, and you said, no, great, go back, come back, you know, get rid of five, come back when you've got one, and we'll work on that. Because people do spread themselves too thin. And I think that, you know, as entrepreneurs and solopreneurs, we're doing so many different things that we really just want one to stick. So we'll work
ourselves silly on more than one different, you know, more than one project.
Just from studying success and talking, you know, really observing and talking to people that got there, you know, way before I ever did anything successful, one of the common elements I noticed was they do one thing at a time. You can do a lot of things in your life, but just do them one at a time. When they have an idea, they have the discipline to tune everything else out and say, don't talk to me about anything else but this until I finish this. So that's the lesson that I learned from people like that is do one thing at a time, spend 100% of your focus on it until you finish it, and then you can do the next thing.
Here's another thing that I really was kind of amazed by, because I don't know where you get the time to do all this, but you went into a very long piece on one of your speeches about info sponging. And I wonder if you'd enlighten everybody as to what that is and how it helps you and your business.
Absolutely. So again, this was part of this same sort of informal study I've been doing for many years, because I've been wondering this. The most successful people in the world, what are they doing different? What are they doing that everybody else isn't? Why are they successful and everybody else isn't? They must be doing something different. And it turns out they are. So info sponging was a technique that I created to mimic one of the activities that I saw that these really successful people did. And that's this. They scan the horizon and they look at the rest of the world to see what everybody else is doing, to see if someone has a brilliant idea that they could steal. And I don't really mean stealing it. I just mean applying it to your industry. I mean, you say, hey, that's a great idea. I should try that. So the problem I was solving is, let's just say someone, you're in healthcare. So what you spend all your time doing is healthcare, right? All your focus is on, if I asked you, hey, Clarissa, I'm going to a banking industry conference, you'd be like, Jeff, I'm in healthcare. I don't want to go to the bank conference.
Right.
But again, what I noticed was the really successful people are taking in a broader scope of the world. So here's what info sponging is. This is a technique I developed that anybody listening can do, but I came up with it to mimic that behavior of trying to absorb more of the world every day. I do this every single day, but even if you can't do it once a day, you know, do this once a week. For you can spend your whole week on healthcare, but 10 minutes a day, you got to leave your industry. And you got to leave, you know, you don't work in healthcare and you don't work for your company. For 10 minutes every day, this is what I do. I challenge myself to learn one new thing every day from some other industry or some other place, something you don't need to know. So maybe you should go read an article about banking. It's 10 minutes and you can spend the whole rest of your day on healthcare. And if you do this every day, you start to absorb ideas and innovations and cleverness from the whole rest of the world around you and in other industries. And what you want to be is the first person in your business, your industry, to figure out how to apply some cool new idea to your industry in the way that no one has ever thought of before you. That's the idea of info sponging.
Right. So it's kind of connecting the data points is what you said in your speech. And there, you know, there was an edited picture, and I don't know if that was really your wall or not, of just a gajillion post-it notes. And I don't know if that's really, is that really your wall, Jeff, that gajillion post-it notes?
No, that one wasn't.
Okay. That was a lot of information. That's a lot of data right there. So
I updated that one to mine, which has a handful. But the point is, when you read something, let's say it's a new technology or a new consumer trend, and you can't stop thinking about it. The point of that was I take each of those things and I write down one sentence about them.
Yeah.
One sentence about some new technology or some new trend, and I put those post-it notes up on the wall, and I'm constantly looking over at them. Right. And I'm just looking at them and saying, somewhere in all this data is a pattern. If I could connect all these dots, I know there's a good idea in there. That's the point of doing it very visually and sticking ideas, thoughts that you have up on the wall in post-its or whatever, however you want to do it, so that they're constantly kind of floating around in your mind.
Right. I love the story that you tell about your encounter with Sam Walton, where, you know, he gets up and he gets out of the office and he goes and he sort of just sits and meets and percolates and has a coffee or a donut with his actual client base, customer base. And I love if you tell the story, because how did you meet Sam Walton first off?
Well, I can't tell the story, but this may not make me proud. we were a vendor and Walmart was a customer, and I had a meeting. I can't believe I'm telling the real story. I don't even tell this part.
Of course you are.
I had a meeting in their corporate office, and I was waiting for their CFO. That's who the meeting was with. And Sam Walton was apparently periodically would take a vendor, someone that does business with Walmart, once every quarter, every once in a while, a couple times a year, he'd take someone that does business with him out to lunch to ask them, what is it like to do business with us? Which I thought was brilliant. However, it wasn't me. I was waiting, and Sam Walton came back in, and he said, are you my lunch appointment? And I said, yes. And I was not.
And you were.
And he said, he said, let's go. And so I got a chance to go spend some of the afternoon. And by the way, I later confessed.
And priceless.
Expecting, Jeff Hoffman, expecting anger. And he said, you know what? He said, that's pretty darn smart to jump on a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity
exactly.
like that, so I'm not mad.
For sure. So, that's kind of,
he said,
go ahead, yeah.
I go do, ahead. You do owe an apology to whoever I was supposed to be having lunch with. Anyway, he told me a really quick story. I was asking him, how do you know when an idea is good? And he said, he was telling me it was about listening to the right people. And he was telling me that early on, everybody in retail, all the experts in the retail business were saying, you can't build big box retail in small town America. Mm-hmm. Basically, the Walmart idea was destined to failure. And all the quote experts said that. And I said, but you built it anyway. And you did that anyway. And he said, because I didn't listen to the experts, I listened to the farmers. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, my customers, my employees and my customers don't live in the same town. My employees are not, in fact, farmers. My team isn't, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, so we live in a different part of town. We eat at different restaurants. We shop in different stores. So mm-hmm. it occurred to me that how are we designing a product for people that aren't us, which is a good question for everybody listening to ask. If you're not literally the exact demographic of your customer, then your opinion shouldn't matter. And I said to Sam, I said, what did you do? And he said, every other Friday, I would put on, you know, a John Deere hat and some work boots. And a lot of times I would go all the way across town. And I would sit in the little cafe with the farmers and just eat apple pie and listen to people talk and chat right. with them. They had no right. idea that I was in retail. They had right. no idea that I lived on the other part of town. I dressed like them and sat with them all day and listened to them. So it was a huge lesson for me that right. some days you need to change clothes, you need to leave your office, and you need mm-hmm. to go spend the day wherever your customer is without right. selling anything. Don't wear yeah. your company shirt and don't tell them about you. Just listen. And absorb right. how they handle their life and what they worry about and what they think about. And that was the lesson he taught me. And he said that the farmers convinced him how to build his stores, not the Wall Street experts.
Right. Okay. So as all of this wasn't enough, everything else that you do, you decided that you wanted to start producing movies and musical events and some concerts and tours and charity events. And you've worked with the likes of Elton John and Britney Spears and many others. So why the, it seems like it's kind of divergent now. It takes away from where you were before and what you were impassioned by before. Now you are in a whole different category, a whole different realm. Of business. So what was the thought process behind you that move for you?
Sure. And it was trying to find and understand the intersection between, you know, kind of left brain and right brain. Mm-hmm. you know, now there's more focus on, for example, design thinking and mm-hmm. how we bring together, you know, art and science. And the intersection of those two things is much more powerful than any one of them on their own. So what I started thinking is I'm an engineer. I'm a software engineer by trade. I'm mm-hmm. spending too much time around engineers and mathematicians and, again, left brain people. And I thought if I expose myself to the creative process, to being around creative people like artists and musicians and actors, yeah. I would probably learn how to develop the other side of my brain and how to add creativity to science and get a better product overall. So that's why I got into music and film. Because I wanted to learn the creative process from the other side and see mm-hmm. if that would enhance my ability to do what I do. And it was fun. We did everything from concerts with NSYNC to tours with Britney Spears and Elton John. And I got to be around, I got to watch creative people create. It was a wonderful learning experience and a lot of fun at the same time.
An experience and that's it. Never again, or you're always open for a new idea?
No, we're still involved. Still involved around both music, film, and now television a little bit, because you really never stop learning. In fact, if you ever think you're done learning anything, you're in big trouble.
Exactly.
So I still like having access, and we're still involved in those industries as well.
So the last time I spoke to you, we saw each other in person. It sounds like you're taking a jump into some sports teams. You know, I think you're talking about the NFL, the NBA, the MLB, and the NHL. So do tell, pray.
Yes. Yeah, so we launched a new fund just this year, and the fund is in place to buy professional sports teams. We're going to start with buying an NFL football team. But part of it, I'll be honest, is we want to change the narrative of way sports ownership is today, because sports ownership today is not very diverse. It tends to be statistically older white men. So there isn't enough influence of women in ownership of professional sports or minorities. And so we want to bring women into ownership. We want to bring minorities into ownership. We want to bring another whole level of revisiting the relationship between teams and athletes and communities and their responsibility to them. So it's bigger than just owning a football team, but that's what we're doing. We're looking at NFL teams, putting together a deal to buy an NFL football team, but we want to be part of the next definition of sports owner, or the next generation of redefining sports ownership.
That's
so it's a little bit mission-oriented, not just
extraordinary. Are you able to tell us what team, or is that?
No, not yet. Not yet. But we don't have a deal. We don't have a deal yet anyway. So we're that's all still being developed. So I don't have any news to report there, but I promise I will let you know when
we
do.
Well, I want to be the first, right? You're going to let me know. I'll be
the first one to ask that. So I will definitely let you know.
Oh, awesome. That's extraordinary. Well, I just love that, you know, how diverse you are. And like, as you said before, just, you know, continuing to learn and even if it means, you know, being pretty much out of your comfort zone, I would imagine, because I wouldn't be able to go into what you do. Here's another story that I really liked. I don't know where it was or what company it was that you're working on. And you know, you say hire people that are better, you know, at doing what they do than you could ever be, to get a good team on board. And somebody came out to you one day and said, Jeff, you know, you really suck at coding, so go do something else. And you're like, wait a minute, I'm a coder. That's what I do. I code computers. He goes, yeah, but you're not good at it, so go do something else. I mean, that was extraordinary for you to hire somebody that's able to talk to you that way. But I guess call a spade spade, right?
Yeah, you want to surround yourself with people smarter than you in every single area, until you find one you can contribute in. And I actually thought, I mean, my degree is computer science. I was a programmer, and I hired what I thought were the smartest programmers I could find. And one day they basically pulled me aside and said, you're so far behind us, we don't want you working with us anymore.
Right.
And my goal was to hire smart people, but they said, you're just not great at this. We're all way better than you. Stop doing it. Go find something else to do.
Did that hurt your feelings? Did that hurt you at all?
It did.
How did you take that initially?
It did, but we had one clear mission, the best possible product and the best possible service we could create. So my task to them was that the mission has to win. What matters is not my ego or anyone else's. What matters is we build the best possible product we can and take the best care of our customers we can. So they came to me and said, if our goal is the best possible products and the best possible service, then we have to be honest with you. You're not creating that. And so in this area, so you told us to tell you the truth, that's the truth. So while it hurt my feelings, it enabled me to take the company to a whole new level, because I moved out of the way and these people created amazing things without me. And it turned out I was better at something else that I probably would have never tried if somebody hadn't been honest with me.
Well, that was pretty humble of you, I must say. I think that's pretty awesome. Before we were talking about how you know, you're telling everybody, you know, solve real problems that, you know, everybody else would love to see solved as well. And you said something along the lines of achieve excellence in just doing that one thing that you're really good at. So I guess to that point, the other thing that you talk about is being the best at what you do, to love what you're doing, and then that the world sees what you're doing as value, you know, that you're bringing real true value. So can you just kind of go through that a little bit?
Yeah, and you're right. What you're trying to do is find, you know, we actually have a name for that. We call that your golden purpose. Your golden purpose is this intersection of three things. It's something that you're passionate about, you love doing. It's something you're really good at doing, and it's something that the world values, right? That they actually want and would pay for. If you can find the intersection of those three, you find yourself in your life doing something you love doing, you happen to be really good at it, and the rest of the world wants that thing, then you've found your golden purpose in life. So it's important to keep asking those things. Am I really good at this? Do I absolutely love doing this? And does anyone else in the world care about this? Will somebody actually pay me for it? So we stay really focused on that golden purpose. In fact, we kind of say, you know, use the Olympic model, go out and win a gold medal at something. And so that means you got to find what your gold medal talent is.
Right. And that's
not
always.
When you do, go do that thing.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to ask you, I wasn't quite sure what idea harvesting is. I think I have an idea, but I wanted you to tell me. And then you also teach innovation workshops. So kind of what is idea harvesting and what happens in your innovation workshops?
So idea harvesting, we covered part of it. It starts with that info sponging idea of going and looking at clever ideas that other industries have created in other companies and try to see if you can apply them to your business. That is a big piece of the idea harvesting piece, is to constantly collect ideas from all over and stare at them and say, can I do something with these ideas? A really fast example of that was that meant a lot to me when I read the story, because it was a true story, was years long ago in the fast food industry, they'd run out of ideas how to make their hamburger joint any better. And one of the employees said, I'm going to go see if I can harvest some ideas from other industries. And he went visiting banks, and he didn't learn much in the first few banks. But the fourth bank that he visited, when he got there, he couldn't park because there were pickup trucks in the lot. There were piles of wood, hammers and nails, and carpenters. And he said, hey, what are you guys doing outside of the bank in the parking lot? And they said, oh, we got this really cool idea. We're about to make it. And he said, what is it? And they said, well, when we build it, we're going to call it a drive-through window. And so he shot back to his hamburger joint and said, oh, my God, that's a brilliant idea. We should do that. So the first drive-through window in fast food history didn't even come from the industry. It came from the banking industry and a guy that was out there harvesting ideas. And he saw that and he said, this is really cool. I'm going to do it. So they were the first fast food chain. Later, they were acquired by McDonald's for that innovation. So idea harvesting is making sure you're looking for ideas outside of your office in the rest of the world. And the innovation workshops, I've been doing these with a lot of companies that bring me in. We conduct, it's usually like at least a half day, where we walk through this and some other techniques on we actually do this exercise, this info sponging and these idea harvesting. We talk about the industry, then we talk about ideas in other industries, and we try to list places that we might find ideas that we could, quote, steal, right? Like the drive-through window. So I love teaching these because we try to teach people to stop looking down at the work on your desk all day long and schedule some time periodically to go investigate the whole rest of the world.
So I know that you're in Ohio and you said you've got an event tomorrow. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
So we did this trying to challenge the next generation, all of our youth, to become problem solvers, not complainers. Instead of observing the world and telling us what you don't like, just fix it, own it. So we're doing a big contest that we call the We Solve Problems Essay Contest. We ask high school students all over to pick a problem that bothers them in the world today as a high school student and then propose a solution. And tomorrow, we're actually going to pick all the finalists and we're going to give them money. The reward is they get cash that they can either use to go to college or they can use it to actually implement their solution. But the idea is we want them to realize that you know, there is no they. They don't fix the world around you. They don't make it better. You do. So when you see a problem, why don't you try to solve it? And what we're going to do is publicly reward the ones that came up with solutions on their own. So that's what we're doing tomorrow with hundreds of high school students.
Oh, I love that idea. That's awesome. What's the one thing, what's at the top of the list of you know, what's bothering these kids today, our kids? What's the one thing that you hear over and over again?
I there's probably more than one, but I'll tell you one that's really ringing loudly. I'm going to phrase it wrong. It's sort of cyberbullying. And what I mean by that, it's not just bullying. It's the fact that the reason we keep having these school shootings. To make them worry every day when they go to school is that that no one is picking out the warning signs of the kids crying out for help. This is what I hear a lot of these students say, that they can tell you right now who's the kind of weird kid at their school that's a loner, likely, it's probably unhappy and needs help before they get to a point where they decide life's not worth living and they either kill themselves or kill other people. So they're saying mental health, and mental health made worse by social media that makes you feel not adequate because you're not as beautiful as the girl who keeps posting her pictures or because someone's bullying you. They're really concerned about the fact that every time there's one of these incidents, everybody says, yeah, he was weird and he had threatened people with guns before and no one does anything about it. Right. They want a whole new level of mental health awareness.
Okay. Jeff, I thank you so much for being on the show today. We've got to close because we get went a little bit over, but that's okay, because the more information you give us, the better we feel. So again, thanks a lot for being here on In the Limelight with Clarissa Burt. Everybody, we will be back next Tuesday. Same time, same place, another super influencer. Bye for now.
Thank you for joining your host, Clarissa Burt, for In the Limelight. Be sure to come back for another great show next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time and 11 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Influencers Channel. Make this your week.